Hello and welcome to our podcast series, The Family of Things, a series of interviews where we explore ideas, life and living with people determined to get the most out of their time on this planet. Now, in this episode, I'm with a man with a global vision, Hans Sommer, director of THOCUS. And THOCUS is a network of NGOs, non-governmental agencies, focused on international development, human rights, and combating poverty and inequality. Now, Hans, I know your arena is the world, but I'm interested in where your own world started. I mean, I know you're Dutch, you grew up in the Netherlands, but as a child, you spent quite a bit of time in Africa.
Yeah, I was born in the Netherlands, but when I was about 6 months old, we moved to Cameroon. My dad was a teacher in a technical school, and we spent 3 years of my life in a village in Cameroon.
And what was that like? Because you were young, a child, and it must have been quite vivid, a very deep experience for a young child.
Yeah, to be honest, I have not many memories and many images that I'm not sure if they're dreams or if they were memories. But it continued, obviously, when we moved back to the Netherlands. My parents always had African people, Cameroonians, living in the Netherlands or visiting the Netherlands over. So I was very accustomed to the fact that we had different cultures. And in fact, many words in my house were French words because I wouldn't know the Dutch equivalent for goat or for truck and et cetera. So we had a bit of a unusual household, I guess, from the start. It obviously has informed my life. My dad went into development at a later stage as well, and also went before he worked for Philips, the electronics giant. And he used to travel a lot for that as well, and he'd bring home mangoes and exotic fruits. And from my earliest memories, I was always fascinated by that fruit could be so different, that smells could be so different.
And your parents must have been unusual people. Were they very open-minded? What kind of culture or ethos did they bring you up with?
They're very good Presbyterians. Presbyterians are an interesting lot. And there's a book written about Presbyterians in the Netherlands. And one of the case studies is my family. In fact, three generations of women in my family. So say 100 years ago, Presbyterianism in the Netherlands was very, very austere. And then over the generations, in my parents' generation, they clearly still have a very strong belief, but they also had doubts about the church and about the rigid interpretation of what the Bible says, etc. And so they brought us up in a very questioning way, very much stressing this thing about your own responsibility, your own brain to make up your mind, obviously to take the Bible and other texts, you know, as an instruction, but not as a rule from which you can't deviate. So we were brought up very much with that responsibility, you know, make up your own mind, and a very strong sense of justice. And then so the third generation, my sister and myself, we took a step in our teens to formally deregister from the Presbyterian Church for a variety of reasons.
It's kind of interesting that you talk about your roots coming from Presbyterianism and religion. Does that, in a sense, still influence you when you look at the world or when you think about ethos, values?
Well, I'm an atheist myself, and I don't actually think we need an external being to tell us what is right or wrong. I'm more of a humanist where you feel like the values are in ourselves, and what is good about this planet is that we share it with other people. And obviously, I think most religions share this one instruction, is that you have to look after each other and to do unto others as you'll have them do to you. But it's not limited to religions. It's just sort of a human value.
If you think about it now, when you're raising your children, have you made that decision with your wife to raise them with or without religion?
We had an interesting set of discussions about that, because I think in Ireland, educational choice is very limited. And so our nearest school is a Catholic school. But we went to talk to the headmistress, and we said, look, we're not Catholic. Is that a problem? And we were really impressed with the way the school has interpreted that Catholic background. And we actually ended up baptizing our kids, because also I think we both grew up in a religious household, and it did give us something. We both ended up rejecting that later in life, but I think we should give that to the kids as well.
Being raised as a Protestant, from your perspective, has probably given you that sense of independent thinking.
Yeah, I think so. And my parents, they grew up in the Second World War. They experienced the Nazis firsthand. My grandfather was jailed by the Nazis and put on death row. And I think that really shaped my parents' thinking also, that, you know, you cannot also just trust the state, because the state can do evil things in this case. And so, you know, I don't know if it's the Presbyterianism or that experience, but that really, for me, they instilled for me very early on this importance of taking responsibility for your actions and not taking things at face value.
Which really has governed your adult life. But your grandfather, just pausing on that, what happened to him? What was that story?
This is amazing. My grandfather looked a bit Jewish and he was arrested because in the area there had been a few attacks by the resistance against the German forces. So they were going to do reprisal killings. Basically, the deal was next time you shoot a German soldier, we'll shoot one of these prisoners. So he was one of 20 men and they weren't fed in jail. So my granny, who had four children at this time, had to cycle on a bicycle without rubber tires 20 kilometers back and forth every day to bring him his food in jail while she was raising four kids in a war situation. It's an amazing story, and he never really talked about it. He's dead now, but to the end of his days, he would not go on holiday in Germany. You know, it obviously left a scar that was too deep.
And this is something that in Ireland, and you probably have felt and experienced that, is that we have a very strange experience in this country with World War II and that generation. From the Netherlands, it's quite different. What you grew up with and what your family grew up with is a completely different concept of fascism.
Absolutely. And I lived there around Eindhoven in the south. And in the forest around the village where we lived, there was a memorial for a 18-year-old soldier from Seattle who had basically saved his platoon. I'm not sure what the story was in the liberation of the Netherlands. So for me as a young child, obviously soldiers were cool, but I saw that story and I thought, 18-year-old, you know, and he's dead now. And he probably didn't know where the Netherlands was before he was stationed there. So yeah, I think for people in the Netherlands, we were liberated by the Canadians mainly. So Canada is, for most people, my parents' generation, is just the promised land because these people came and, you know, they had never heard of the Netherlands, but they went there and risked their lives for our freedom, which I find amazing. So for my parents, obviously, that growing up in the war was a big thing. And I guess for me also, growing up in the 80s, the cruise missiles debate was a huge thing. I grew up, you know, in this sort of this angst of, you know, world obliteration through nuclear disaster. So my coming of age was when the demonstrations in the early 80s against the plans to station cruise missiles in the Netherlands. It's when I became politically active and started going to demonstrations.
In Ireland, there would have been Greenham Common, and there was a huge anti-nuclear movement in Ireland. For you, nuclear power, cruise missiles, is that when you felt you became an activist? And in a sense, started demonstrating? Were you out on parades?
I was, yeah. And I was 14 years old. My mum wasn't too happy of me going, because it was actually an overnight demo. And I remember it was the first time I saw mass media at work, because there was a huge demo, completely peaceful. And there was maybe a dozen people who then ended up throwing stuff at the police. And of course, watching it on the news the next evening, that was the bit that made the headlines. And I remember being so frustrated about the misrepresentation of what I had experienced there. And I thought, okay, how does this work? Why does the journalist decide that that is the newsworthy item rather than that there's 100,000 people or however many people there were? So that was really interesting for me. I was very driven, that I was determined to not, you know, be part of the escalation of an arms race. But at the same time, I learned, okay, there's political processes here. Demonstrating is one thing, but it's actually not going to be sufficient. How else can you translate that anger and that, or that concern, into actual policy change? So yeah, I ended up then studying politics in Amsterdam and Copenhagen, because I was just fascinated by that whole process.
And could you have gone down the road of politics and been a politician?
I think I'd find it hard to be a politician. I did think that my ideal job would be sort of a policy advisor to a minister or something. But I also always had this interest in global affairs. And so after college, I volunteered for a development NGO in Brussels. I sort of rolled into this area and I go, okay, I can actually get a job here. My first job was a little consultancy for a Belgian MEP. So I thought, okay, there is actually such a thing as a job in development. That'd be quite interesting. And I just rolled into it from there.
And from there on, I suppose you began to also travel and involve your life in terms of activism, but also development work overseas. I mean, you've worked in Pakistan, for example.
Well, Before I went to Pakistan, I worked 5 years in development NGOs, but I felt very much that I had read the books, so to speak, but I hadn't lived it. My parents had brought us back to Cameroon in the 90s, and it was quite a strange experience because most of what my parents had tried to build up wasn't really there anymore. The area had been a coffee-growing area, and coffee price had fallen so far that it didn't even pay to bring the coffee to the harbour, so that the area was depressed.
Did they really go back with a sense of nostalgia? Did they love Cameroon?
They did, yes, and still do. But they knew that what they were going to see was not a success story necessarily. But I felt that it was also important for me to have more first-hand experience of what development work looks like. So I visited Kosovo during the Serbian War, and I visited India, and then my partner got a job for Trokra in Pakistan. So I gave that as an opportunity to come and, you know, live in a developing country myself.
So let's just talk about that. How did you meet the girl who became your wife?
She was studying in UCD, and you know, like most students in the 90s, had to work in the summers to pay for the rest of the year. So she went to Amsterdam because some of her friends were on an Erasmus to study. So I bumped into her, and we hit it off. And so, yeah, we had a nice time, but she still had to finish college. So she had a year to go in UCD.
So when she finished, and eventually you ended up in Pakistan together working in development, what was that like? What's your memories of that?
I remember sitting in a field in Punjab with farmers there that were part of a program. And basically the program was trying to say to the farmers, you need to diversify your crops. And they showed us that they were doing that. So we said, well, what is wrong? You know, why? How come you're still living in poverty? And they're saying, well, it's very clear. The landlord, it's a feudal land system in Pakistan. The landlord has cut off the irrigation channel. And there's nothing we can do. So we're back to rain-fed agriculture. So no amount of improved seeds and fertilizers and so can help if we don't have the water. So for me, it was a wake-up call that, you know, development and poverty is not about technical fixes. It's also very much about political fixes. This is a political situation, a man-made poverty, not a nature-made poverty. So that was a really, really strong experience for me. It was also the time that Pakistan was sort of descending into the military dictatorship that took place afterwards. So that, again, for me, was such an amazing experience. And to meet so many lovely and nice and smart people in that country, and to see a whole country effectively being held hostage by a minority of extremely violent people, it was a really painful experience. And invitation or an encouragement to continue to say, well, look, global poverty is about global injustice. It's not just about a lack of something, lack of food, lack of shelter, lack of anything. It's actually about injustice and marginalization, discrimination and oppression in many cases. So that was a formative period
so
for me.
In a sense, what you're saying, from Pakistan, you see it as been change comes through political action. Poverty is not necessarily caused by a lack of food. I mean, was that your experience also in Chad?
Exactly. And then essentially we did two things. We worked with farmers in the south where Exxon had found oil. So these farmers were basically being robbed of their land, and we were trying to organize them and help them defend themselves against their own government and a multinational. And we were playing a really interesting role as a go-between, because as a white person, we found it much easier to have access to the likes of Exxon and the likes of the government than those farmers would have. So
they talked to you?
Yeah. And in fact, we got invited to receptions where Exxon employees would speak off the record, and we would know that what they had been telling the government wasn't actually the full truth. And I realized, okay, this is really what development should look like. It does mean international cooperation, and it doesn't mean it's just community level, grassroots level. It's also about linking people. I, as a foreigner, I knew very little about Chad, but what I could bring was my background and my contacts and my ability to translate what the farmers were telling me into a language that the consultants of the World Bank and of the European Union could understand.
So I suppose by Chad, what you're experiencing is the power that you might negotiate in development in being a voice.
Yeah, absolutely.
For those who didn't have one.
Yeah. And I think that for me was then, to bring the circle around, I realized that a lot of what is wrong with this world is not just located in developing countries. In fact, a lot of what is, you know, impacting on these poor people are decisions made in capitals far away, made in Brussels, made in London, Washington. So I went back and said, okay, I need to go back to my own part of the world and change the bits that I see there that are impacting on poor people and that are wrong. The example that I gave is in Chad, a lot of people drink camel milk, but you can't export camel milk to the EU because the EU have decided in their wisdom that camel milk is not fit for human consumption, which is a really odd decision. But, you know, millions of people in the Sahel region drink it every day. So, you know, here's a product that this country has, but it has actually no way of exporting it. So I thought, well, maybe if you can change some of the health and safety or some of the trade barriers, you could actually create development and prosperity in countries like that. So it's always so much more complicated than it looks at first. And I think that's what I really realized. And I thought, okay, if I go back to, you know, Ireland or Netherlands and just show people these linkages and how the choices that you and I make as consumers on a daily basis actually have an impact on people elsewhere. And we will not necessarily see that impact, but we should be aware of it.
So Hans, you came back to Ireland to take up the post with Dóchas, largely, I suppose, because your wife's Irish and you wanted to settle here. But was there any other reasons? I mean, was Ireland something that appealed to you? And how did you feel to making this your home?
My wife wanted to go to the Netherlands when we left Chad, and I wanted to go to Ireland. I like this place. It's the nature. It's also the people. I like the buzz. It's a bit difficult that it is an island and it's hard to get to anywhere else. But I just love being in this country. So it was my choice to go here. And yeah, I still enjoy working here, living here. I think the weather could be better, maybe. But
but it's interesting, and it's always the same, is that when you say something like that, I don't know why, but Irish people immediately think, well, what do you love about us and Ireland? Because we often find so much fault. What do you find, or what do you think about the differences between the Netherlands, the Dutch particularly, and the Irish, and our particular ways of operating, you might say?
Well, it is a double-edged sword. And I think in many ways, the Irish way of being and, you know, not saying no and not being direct is much more common in the world. And certainly in most African countries, you just don't say no to a person's face. And so in many ways, the Dutch or the Germanics in general are very ill-suited to live in developing countries because they just don't get that. And I've decided that actually I like that directness, but it's also, it's a laziness, I think. I think it's an unwillingness to really profoundly empathize. I think Irish people are much better at understanding what the other person will think of what they're about to say. And they are therefore trying to couch it in a way that it doesn't offend. And I think that's difficult at times. And I think a lot of the problems in Ireland are due to our unwillingness to be clear and to our unwillingness to write down rules and then apply them. You know, go back to the Garth.
Follow the rules.
Yeah, exactly. So
not bad at writing them down. It's following them that we sometimes get stuck
on. Yeah, and there's an ability to have two realities in an Irish head. Also, yeah, you have the rules and then you have what we really do. But I think, yeah, so that's the difficulty for Ireland, but it's also the charm, I think. And I think Irish people have a way with words, which is just amazing. And I think there's just the wit and the humor in this country is amazing. And I believe also, we've forgotten that a bit during now the last couple of years of austerity, but what we had in spades in the Celtic Tiger era was this belief and this optimism and thinking, okay, we can do this. We just give it a go. And I really like that. And I hope Ireland can recover that, this confidence that, you know, just trying is important. And failing is okay, you know, and you just get up and do something anew.
And I suppose one of the things that we're credited with, or we like to credit ourselves with, is that we have a propensity to empathize with the developing world because we've come through things. We did have a famine. We have been colonized. We have experienced trauma. We have had a civil war. So we should have some ground to empathize, even if we didn't have the very direct and very immediate past of the Netherlands, say, in World War II.
I think it's the country in Europe with the most empathy for developing countries and poor countries. And this really deep-rooted knowledge and awareness or feeling urge to help and to be live in solidarity with people that are worse off than ourselves. I think there is a downside to it, and that it tends to be a charity mindset. It tends to be about, well, we'll fix this, you know, we'll do something, and we get excited about a particular case. We're not so good in Ireland, I think, at looking at structural issues and really saying, well, this is a symptom of something else. Well, what is that something else? And how do you address that? In my thinking about injustice, injustice is inherently unstable. It's like an upside down triangle, which will fall over if left on its own, but it's being supported by institutions, by laws, by traditions, etc., or by power or by money. So I think people who are wanting to work for social justice, global justice, we need to understand the inherent instability and what those factors are that are keeping it alive. And I think maybe in Ireland we can do a bit more work on trying to really think through issues. I'm not knocking charity. Charity is an incredibly important thing, but it's not enough. And good intentions are not enough. We really do need to look at trying to find structural solutions.
Hans, you now have, I think, 3 children, right?
Yeah.
And in settling here as a family, did you make a decision to raise them in Dutch and English? And obviously there's Irish happening anyway. But what was the choice about combining your cultures and nationalities?
Yeah, I deliberately tried to speak Dutch to them. Now, I did very well with the first one and then got a bit slack in there.
Yeah.
And I got confused because then I ended up speaking to every child that I saw in Dutch because it's sort of, you know, I associated. So it got a bit unworkable. So it's a pity that certainly the young one, he hasn't really got any Dutch and he gets angry when I speak Dutch to him because he wants to understand. But actually all 3 of them have from a young age understood that everything has 2 names, 2 words. And so, you know, usually when a child finds it's not being understood, it will just repeat what it says. Whereas I noticed with my kids that from an early age, they tried to find another way of saying the same thing, which I thought was very impressive.
So you have 6?
5 languages, yeah.
5 languages. Yeah. What's your take on having that many windows on the world?
Yeah, I think that's a really nice way of putting it, because actually every language has words that, you know, for particular phenomena that the other languages don't, and or have just nice turns of phrases. And so it's nice. And in our house, we do use words and expressions from different languages, I guess. And yeah, I think the way you name things in life actually defines who you are. I guess, I don't know if it's a myth, but when they say that Eskimos or Inuit have 50 words of snow, I'm inclined to believe it. And it obviously shows what's important in such a society.
And obviously rain in Irish.
Yeah, but you know, now English is my first language. I have been outside the Netherlands more years than
really?
I have been in. Yeah,
your
yeah.
first language.
Yeah, I dream in English. And
really?
The only thing I don't
do
in...
When did that happen? When did you stop dreaming in Dutch?
I don't know, but it's a while ago, I guess. The only thing I still do in Dutch is count. I cannot seem to be able to count and or do sums in my head in English.
Do you think that's changed you to actually move so radically as an adult from first language to now being an English first language?
I think so. And when I go to the Netherlands, obviously I speak the language perfectly, but I feel like a foreigner. Now, I've been out of the country for more years of my life than in it. But I know I'm not 100% Irish, but I'm certainly more Irish in my head than I am Dutch. Although, not when it comes to football, though. I think in soccer, you just can't switch allegiance, I guess.
Once you know about Saipan, everything else shades into irrelevancy.
That's right.
Hans, in looking at what you do and your work, and I know DOCUS now is taking the lead on the European Year of Development. And at one level, this is an enormous opportunity for Ireland. But also, there's huge challenges. We're coming out of a very deep recession. And it may seem hard to get Irish people to talk about a positive approach to investing more energy resources and their own personal capital in development.
Yeah, I think as long as we continue to think about development as being about overseas aid and about being about charity, then we might have a difficulty. But I guess what we have learned in the last 5-6 years is that we had a development model for Ireland and it was broken. We ran this country into the ground with a development model which was basically buy more stuff and sell more stuff and then eventually we'll all be rich. And now we have to reinvent ourselves. And I think President Michael D. Higgins has said that when he got elected, he wanted to have a rethink about who we are as a nation. And, you know, with the 1916 anniversary coming up, it's important to have a think about, well, what model do we want for the future for ourselves? And Ireland, again, we're not that great at long-term visions. And I think we now have a great opportunity to think about what is a sustainable development model for Ireland. Now, obviously, in my role in DOCUS, we would like to couch that or frame that in an international context, because Ireland is one of the most globalized countries, economies in the world. We cannot decide that we want to go back to being self-reliant and being a little island on its own. We are part of a global society. But at the same time, we need to know who we are and who we want to be able to really make use of the opportunities that the global society offers us. So, yeah, crucially, 2015 is the year for development, not the year for aid or overseas aid. It's the year for sustainable development. So we need to come up with an idea as a nation of how do we want to see our long-term future in a way that it can be sustained both economically but also environmentally and socially. And those are really important dimensions.
And I suppose the difficulty here is that the word development, if I can say it, gets a bit foggy. What does it mean? There's a lot of jargon that floats around the air, including sustainable. So bring it down to ground a bit for me, Hans. What's your vision? What do you want to see happen in Ireland and globally?
Well, for instance, go to climate change. This is a real issue. We are the last generation that can stop the climate get out of control, but we're also the first generation that will experience the impact of a changing climate. So we need to think about now, basically, do we need to drive everywhere? Do we really need to have intensive agriculture here? Do we need to continue to be one of the biggest contributors in the world per capita of climate change, greenhouse gases? I don't think so. I think agriculture is one of the strengths of this country. I think it would be great if we now decided that we wanted to have a model of agriculture that actually is respectful of the environment, that we are looking at.
So what would that mean?
Well, I'm not an agricultural expert, but I certainly think if I was in charge, I would say, well, let's go and go organic as a nation, be the green isle in the truest sense of the word, because that's a niche market, you know, but a growing one. I think if we want to compete with heavily subsidized agriculture in America, it's a no-win situation. I think if you want to go down a monoculture type, which the market says we should, I don't think that's a good thing for Irish society. And I think we are too carbon dependent. All the oil we're using every day here in this country is imported. All the gas we're using is imported. It's not a very smart way to build your country. So I would think, can we go to a less carbon intensive way of farming and less carbon intensive way of working and living? That would be one. I would say maybe let's see if we can go back to living, you know, locally. I think one of the nice things in Ireland is that Buy Irish is a very strong tradition here, and that's a very good one, and I think I'm building it. And in the last couple of years, we've seen the emergence of a grow-it-yourself movement, farmers markets, etc. Supermarkets are trying to sell local produce. That is, I think, for me, the future, that we don't have to buy apples that have been grown in the Czech Republic, then flown to South Africa to be waxed and packaged, and then flown back to Ireland to be sold. We could actually eat Irish apples where they're grown.
So in many ways, the challenge here is for people, Irish people, Europeans, to recognise that development is a cost. It may not be that they actually write a check or do a direct debit. It's the decisions they're taking every day in what they buy, in how they frame their lives.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's about the products that we buy, but it's also the policies we adopt and the way we treat ourselves and each other. Because we have serious development challenges in Ireland in terms of growing inequalities in this society, huge levels of marginalization in, say, you know, inner city Dublin or among traveller communities. And that's not a natural situation. We have created that, in this case, maybe through centuries or decades long of policy making. But it's never too late to reverse that. And I think we need to think about, well, is a grossly unequal society, is that in the long term sustainable? I don't think so.
So from Hans Zomer's point of view, what's your ambition? What's your dream for 2015? What would you really like at the end of the year to be able to say, I did this?
What I would love if we could achieve in 2015 is that people in Ireland understand and really come to terms with that they are global citizens, and that what we do on a daily basis actually has an impact down the line. That we understand the chain of events that we put in train by insisting that we buy only the cheapest T-shirts.
And how do you change that?
The good thing is that it's already changing. There are so many conversations happening in this country already. I think if you come back to where we have been as a country, 20 years ago, if you said you wanted to recycle your newspapers, you'd be, you know, a bit of a loony. If you wanted to buy free-range eggs, people would wonder why, or if you were a vegetarian, why would you do that? All these things are now mainstream. awareness raising does take time. Societal change does take time. But it starts with conversations, I think. And
leadership.
Yes.
But, and possibly policy as well.
Yeah, but policy usually reflects what people think.
I mean, from the perspective of the young activist at 14 protesting against the cruise missiles and where you are now, there might be a sense that sometimes when we look at our journeys that we could be frustrated. We could lose hope.
Well, I don't think I lose hope, but I think there are enormous amounts of bad news. Clearly, humans are messy and we tend to mess up. But for this very reason, we've created something called the World's Best News, which is a new service where we're trying to tell these stories of positive change. Usually positive change is not newsworthy. Mass media, television, radio won't cover it because it's not a headline. And that's understandable, but it doesn't mean it's any less important. So I was telling you about the demonstration that I was at, and you know that makes sense for a media journalist to report if there's some violence. Similarly, that's what newspapers tend to cover. But there is lots of positive news in developing countries. You know, the schools in Pakistan reopened after a horrible attack in Peshawar. That's a fantastic news. It's an act of courage and an act of hope triumphing over despair. But overall, the story of mankind is a very positive one. We are living longer, we're healthier, we're more prosperous than we ever have been. More kids are in school than ever before. And we're eradicating disease after disease. So as a species, we're developing really well. Now, it's never going fast enough, but it's really important that we continue to remind ourselves of the progress that we are making. So the World's Best News is one small attempt to try and highlight some of that positivity that is out there and that we just have to remember to tell each other about.
And you yourself, when you were looking at the start of 2015, you were quoting the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, and his words were, across the world, the fragility of states and institutions has never been more apparent. Some have been hollowed out by corruption. Others have pursued policies of exclusion that drive the victims towards anger, despair and violence. There is that sense of instability and insecurity, which is of the moment. It's been of the moment since way before 9/11 in terms of our relationship with the Islamic world. And that is an interesting dilemma within the journey you're pursuing on development, is that all these things can be pushed forward. And no more than in World War II and the rise of National Socialism, is that security issues, terrorism, political violence can explode, derail and destroy that path.
Absolutely. And I think that in a way, the world we've created is because we have treated international politics as, you know, a means to an end. At the end was profit maximization. And for years, the US and European foreign policy was essentially oil, stability and security. And it didn't matter who you were, as long as we could make money, we'd continue to treat you as our friend. And I think it's time that we realize that profit maximization is not the end to pursue, but it actually is about human development. It's about happiness. And sometimes happiness is not having more money, but having more time. Sometimes happiness is having a nicer village to live in, having a greater choice of newspapers to read, having more diversity in our lives. And I think if you look at it that way, and if you build your engagements with the international community on the principle of rights and on the principles of inclusion, and if you realize that having millions of young males unemployed, disenfranchised, marginalized, that is not in our interest, because it will come back to bite us.
And Hans, across your journey in work and in your personal life, what would you see has been the element that makes you feel happiest? That's your achievement.
That's a difficult one. I guess I get my pleasure from small things. If there's a single thing I should mention, is I remember the day on the 30th of June 2005 when there was a march in Dublin. 20,000 people marched on O'Connell Street and Merrion Square asking for more aid and better aid and fair trade. Now, that was the Make Poverty History March. We organized that. That was organized by a 3-staff team. It was a phenomenal achievement for the small team in Docus. I remember looking back at that thinking, this is really important. And I know from feedback that we got from ministers at the time that they were flabbergasted that that number of people would come out for essentially an issue that has nothing to do with their daily bread and butter.
Or their personal benefit.
And, yeah. And I think that's what keeps me going, that I know that there is such a wide support in Ireland for a better world. And we may have different views of what that better world means, but we are all, by and large, all of us in this country are committed to doing our bit.
Heroes and influences, Hans, because you've taken a very particular policy and ethical path in your life. Who has shaped it?
Well, I'd have to say my parents, my dad's choice of career obviously had a really strong influence. I don't know. I also remember my French teacher in secondary school. Most of the kids didn't like him. He was very odd. I liked French, and he seemed to like the fact that there was at least one kid in the class that liked French. He wasn't teaching us French language. He was teaching us French culture and a love for language. I can't actually remember his name, but he, you know, the way he was I thought, just so encouraging and so, I found, empowering. This was, I think, the first time a teacher really acknowledged me as a person. Yeah, maybe because he needed, you know, an ally in the class, because the rest of the class was pretty disinterested.
But I think it's really important, the significance of a good teacher. People keep coming back to it. And when we think about who shapes us, if it's not our families, for good or bad, the next big hit for us has to be the school. And if we find a good teacher, it can be the change that we need to shape us.
Yeah, absolutely. As a teenager, it's so important that that you get the sense that people actually are listening to you, not that you're not just being told what to do, but that these people actually are interested in you as a person. So yeah, he would probably rate up there as well.
And I guess in this journey where you've lived in a lot of countries which have experienced conflict, injustice and poverty, worst experiences, maybe a thing that comes from that which shaped your inner journey and maybe propelled you?
Well, Chad has a series of bad experiences for me. There was so much violence and it was unreported, and there was a civil war going on which never made headlines in Europe, which was in itself very frustrating, but also at the micro level, just a senseless violence of, essentially, it's a conflict about water and climate change and patterns of life becoming untenable because of the growth of the desert. And so people who used to live very happily and peacefully side by side are now being forced into a sort of a conflict situation. And
for that survival.
And that being translated as a conflict between Islam and Christianity, but in reality, obviously, it's very more profound than that. And, you know, then people with very little education getting very hot-headed and starting to take it out on their neighbours, just shooting people in the market.
And did you see much of that?
Yeah, and we worked with people in the south of Chad who were not opposed to the oil exploration project, but they were concerned about it. And the government portrayed them as being anti-government and anti, you know, national interest. And people that I would have worked with being attacked in their homes by, clearly, the militia from the government. And there was one instance where we were meant to travel down in a car in the south of Chad, and that car was attacked and shot, and one of my staff was wounded. And we were supposed to be in that car. And I thought, this is getting very close now. And, you know, the guys who did it were arrested and freed within a couple of hours because obviously they'd had the right connections. And so that again made me realize the importance and how lucky we are to live in a country where the rule of law actually does mean something. And it's not the rule of violence. And in Chad, literally, you can buy a gun for about the price of two chickens, you know. So if you want to get rich, that's what you do. And that general lawlessness, I found out really, really hard to live with.
Hans, from the perspective of 2015, we've talked about the big ambitions here in Ireland. What would you love to see happen?
Well, I'd love to maybe convey the key message that, yes, the world is a confusing place, but we can all make a difference. And what we do in our daily lives actually makes a difference. Everybody is potentially a change maker. I guess if we can achieve something this year is that if we can instill that feeling of in people that, yeah, they can make a difference. They matter in this. And development is not just about things and people far away. It's about the choices we make on a daily basis. So maybe people can read up a bit, look up on the websites, or, you know, ask themselves, what am I doing that is potentially impacting on other people? What habits do I have in terms of what I buy, where I drive, etc., that are actually, if you multiply that by 2 million or 5 million, that they become problematic at a societal level. So maybe just that one thing is to see yourself as a change maker and as a person that can help build a better planet.
Hans Zummer, director of DOCUS and leader on the European Year of Development here in Ireland. Best of luck with the year, and thank you very much.